to the next case, which is Livingston versus Associate Finance. Mr. Sandler?
Please, the court. Good morning. My name is Andrew Sandler from the Skadden Arps Law Firm. I am here today for the appellant, the associates, and their successor, Citigroup. We have before the court this morning two issues. The first is the court below's failure to compel arbitration pursuant to an arbitration agreement entered into between the parties pursuant to a consumer loan transaction. The second issue before the court this morning is the decision of the court below to certify this class under Rule 23, notwithstanding the court's failure to conduct a Rule 23 analysis or to provide the defendant below with the opportunity to conduct discovery or to brief Rule 23 issues. With respect to the arbitration issue, the starting point for analysis is, of course, the emphatic federal policy favoring arbitration. The court below determined not to compel arbitration for two reasons. One, because a defendant did not prove that costs would not be excessive, and two, because of a concern that the arbitrator could hypothetically fail to award statutory fees provided for to the prevailing plaintiff under the Truth in Lending Act. We would submit this morning that the court's decision placing the burden upon the defendant to demonstrate that the plaintiff would not be subject to excessive fees turns the Supreme Court standard set forth in the Greentree decision on its head. There, the Supreme Court made it clear that it is the party challenging the arbitration that must establish a likelihood of excessive costs. This was the conclusion initially reached by the magistrate below and agreed by the court below in providing the plaintiffs with an opportunity to go back and conduct discovery and go back to the court and seek to establish a likelihood of excessive costs. The plaintiffs below did not do so. Essentially, they abandoned that approach and abandoned that argument and came back to the court merely arguing with the possibility that the arbitrator might not award fees pursuant to TILA was the grounds upon which the court should not compel arbitration. We would submit that in any event, the plaintiff below could not have met that burden for several reasons. Specifically, the arbitration agreement itself, while a fee-splitting agreement expressly provided that in the event that the plaintiff felt unable to pay the fees, that the defendant would initially do so. It also specifically referenced the American Arbitration Association cost provisions, which provide an opportunity for the plaintiff to seek a reduction in cost of fees if they cannot pay it, and then further provided that the defendant would pay costs and fees if the AAA did not diminish them, subject only to later consideration by the arbitrator. And of course, in these circumstances, should the arbitrator later decide to impose costs and fees on the plaintiff, which could be deemed excessive, the plaintiff had the opportunity to seek judicial review. And it is and the defendant further established that they would in fact pay the fees pursuant to a suggestion by Judge Kennelly in the companion very similar Phillips case, which dealt with the same arbitration agreement, and it was really upon the defendants specifically representing that they would do so that Judge Kennelly found that arbitration could be compelled there, and we would suggest with the reason why plaintiffs here abandoned their discovery and their effort to prove excessive costs and fees, but rather went only with their other arguments. What appellants then are left with is the argument that they should be permitted to decline to both argue that costs and fees are excessive and then decline the offer of the defendants to pay those costs and fees for the purpose of defeating the arbitration provision, the arbitration agreement. And we would submit that that position is directly inconsistent with federal law emphatically favoring arbitration. And indeed, even if there were any concerns or thoughts with respect to the cost and fees provision of the arbitration agreement, as the arbitration agreement itself contains a severability clause, those could simply be addressed by severing that issue and sending the case to arbitration as the parties have agreed. The second argument raised by the district court in its order was the hypothetical possibility that the arbitrator would make the wrong decision down the road. There is a very clear line of cases emanating back from the Supreme Court's Gilmer and Schuessen decisions that one cannot defeat arbitration based on the mere possibility of future error by the arbitrator. That is why there is a judicial review function allowed should the arbitrator in fact make this hypothetically anticipated mistake. The appropriate way to address that is judicial review, but the federal policy favoring arbitration must be in play here and the case sent to arbitration. And thus we would ask the court to remand the case with an order requiring the court below to stay the matter and compel arbitration. The issue of class certification would only arise in the event that the court felt that the case was properly before the federal district judge, notwithstanding the arbitration agreement.
Before you get into that, that other case was settled, and we received that paperwork Friday. Do you think that that settlement has any res judicata effect in this case at all?
No, Your Honor. I believe the case that you're referring to is not the companion Phillips case in front of Judge Kennelly, but the California global settlement, which involved an extensive FTC investigation over a multiple period of years, 6 to 8 class actions around the country, and which settled with compensation to consumers of $240 million. No, that does not have res judicata. That was an arm's length settlement as found by the court in California, approved by the federal court in Georgia that had the FTC case, involving the Federal Trade Commission itself. And the issues in that case only very modestly overlap with the issues in this case because the Truth in Lending Act is not part of that settlement. Moreover, the plaintiffs in the case below have opted out of the California settlement. So there was no substantive adjudication. The defendants in the California case did not take any position in that litigation inconsistent with the positions they've taken below here, but rather agreed to class certification with respect to a different set of claims solely for the purpose of entering into a global nationwide settlement requiring them to pay $240 million to consumers. And this was an agreement by the successor organization, Citigroup, with respect to allegations relating to the practices of the predecessor institution. Unless there are any other further questions with respect to that aspect, I'll move on to the class certification issue. With respect to the class certification issue, what happened below was that the defendant filed a motion to compel arbitration and also a motion to strike the class certification motion for reasons related to the arbitration agreement. The defendant below, appellant here, was very, very careful to preserve its later right to challenge Rule 23 class certification. Specifically, it found a motion which was approved by the court below to stay class certification consideration. And then, in an exercise of belt and suspenders, it further requested a clarification of the schedule in the case below to ensure that the court was in agreement that briefing of class certification and discovery with respect to class certification was to be put off until after the motions related to the arbitration agreement were resolved. What then happened was that the court below declined to compel arbitration and certified the class prior to the defendant having any opportunity either to answer the complaint, to conduct discovery, or to brief the class certification issues. We believe that raises two very, very considerable legal problems. One, as set forth by the Supreme Court in Falcon and as followed by many other cases, it deprived the court of the opportunity to look beyond the pleadings and make the factual and legal inquiry that is so important to a Rule 23 decision. And by way of example, among the issues that the court was not then able to consider was the issues in the Jefferson v. Security Pacific case, another district court decision, where the court had determined that TILA damages were subject to a statute of limitations of 1 year. Here the court certified a class for 3 years. And secondly, that the right of rescission under the Truth in Lending Act is a personal right and not a class issue. It is these kinds of issues that need to be fairly and fully adjudicated, and which is the whole basis for the Falcon line of cases promoting the need for the adversary process in Rule 23 considerations. There's also a very significant due process violation here because the defendant below was declined the opportunity, notwithstanding the court's express agreement that it had reserved its rights to do so, to conduct discovery and brief this issue. And I would point the court to the American Medical decision out of the Sixth Circuit, which focuses on this issue in a context where there had been a full discovery and adjudication. A parent company was brought in, and 3 days later the class was certified as to the parent company. I would submit that here the due process issues are much more significant because there had been no opportunity for the district court to obtain the benefits of the adversary process or for the defendant to exercise its right to challenge the class certification claims. And with that, Your Honors, I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are any other questions from the bench.
Thank you, Mr. Sandler.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dan Edelman representing the plaintiffs. First, let me correct the statement made as to the effect of the California proceeding. The California settlement wipes out all mortgage flipping cases involved in this case on behalf of class members. The Livingstons opted out. The Livingstons could not opt out a class and therefore a substantial portion of the case in the trial court is gone. This was done not for $240 million, but for 10% of that amount. It was done at the last minute when the case was broadened to include a national class on flipping claims. It would have wiped out the truth in lending claims the way the relief was originally drafted, but we appeared in the California court, and that was as a result of our objection. The truth in lending claim was removed from the release, no consideration having been paid for it. With respect to the arbitration issue, the question presented is not whether the plaintiffs proved that the arbitration clause as originally put in the contract imposed excessive costs, or when one has to prove that, but whether the defendant can unilaterally alter an arbitration clause. The defendant in this case put in an overreaching arbitration agreement which imposed costs on subprime borrowers that were clearly beyond their means just by who the customers were, and thereby defeats 95-99% of the claims. People see the clause, they find out what the costs are, they can't afford it, and they don't do anything.
Well, what about the fact that the defendant offered to pay all costs of arbitration?
The problem with that is that in response to our discovery, the defendants said, let's not go through with that, we'll first pay. And they made a vague offer that they'll pay some of the costs, and then they made a second offer that they'd pay all of the costs. And the short answer to that is, we never agreed to it. Arbitration, as this court has made clear in the Steinkamp case and in the Stone case just last week, is a creature of agreement, and there's no presumption that one entered into the agreement. The original agreement as found in the contract, as counsel described it, is a fee-splitting arrangement. It requires the plaintiffs to pay substantial costs. It provides for a waiver only if they can show financial inability, which most people that own a house may not qualify for. They basically have to show that they get a fee waiver in federal court. And then it specifically says that there are other costs, such as the cost of the arbitrators, their compensation, which we're not agreeing to pay. And those normally would be split by the arbitrator, and they're quite substantial. We're talking about three lawyers who get $200 to $300 an hour, 8 hours a day, times whatever number of days is necessary to both conduct the hearing and read the materials and consider the issues.
And in that second offer, that's what defendants agreed to pay them as well.
Well,
correct?
Defendants offered to pay.
Right.
Correct. But we never accepted that offer. And you can't just say that the offer cures the problem. The initial contract is a fee-splitting agreement.
Right. But does the district court have to weigh, in consideration of the prohibitive costs, do you think that a factor the district court should consider is the defendant's offer to pay all the costs?
That is a different agreement, and I don't believe that the district court can consider unless the plaintiff agrees to it. Here's why. The substitute agreement that they proposed contemplates that one party to a dispute would pay the decision maker, the judge, and the judge will know that. Now, whether such an arrangement would pass muster if somebody actually agrees to it is one thing. It's a totally different thing.
Is there a case law that says that if one party agrees to pay the arbitration cost, that voids the arbitration agreement because it's an indication that the judges are being swayed by the folks paying their fees?
There are cases going both ways on the effect of the defendant's offer.
Let me go back and try it again. Is there a case that says when one party agrees to pay the arbitration fees that it's immediately voids the arbitration agreement because there's an implication that the judges will follow the money they're getting?
I cannot offhand think of a case that holds that. I was involved in a Florida case which said
the cause of action for discussing, and that's why I didn't have research to find out whether or not.
And there are cases which hold that an arrangement like that with a judge, a court system, is invalid. We didn't cite it in our briefs, but there are cases holding, for example,
what do you mean, somebody paying the judge? I don't think that's pretty easy.
There are cases which involving justice of the peace systems in certain states, in which one repetitive litigant would pay the entire compensation of the judge, and the litigant could select which judge was involved, and those decisions, which I can supply, held the system to be unconstitutional.
No, normally speaking, the cost in a JP proceeding occurred after the finding one way or another. The loser paid the JP. The plaintiff started up in the original cost, but eventually he could assess the cost against him. But this is not an arbitration in this process. They'd set up very carefully. They split it and so on and so on, and assess fees and so on. Those are different. I don't want to know whether there's any case that says if one party pays the agrees to pay the arbitrator's fees, and that voids the arbitration agreement. Which is what you implied in your head first.
No, that is not my argument.
You said one of the reasons I did this is they agreed to pay the judge and I would give a whole case there is something wrong with it. That's why the plaintiff would agree to it.
But my point is the plaintiff has the option of deciding do I want to take this risk or not.
A selling, however, if there was no option, to just provide it, for instance, that when we if you file a settlement, you want to go to it. You won't deny arbitration. You won't pay the arbitration agreement. Is there anything wrong with that?
There are cases which consider that in finding arbitration clauses to be unconscionable. Yes, Your Honor.
Can you give me one case?
There's a California case.
Okay, there we go.
ITT.
Until the next week, can you
supply that?
Yeah.
The argument I'm making here is a slightly different one. It is that before you get to that question, you have to determine that the plaintiff, in fact, agreed to such a system.
I understand that. I was not part of the question. What you said was right, that this whole thing is relatively unfair because the plaintiff, instead of paying the cost, the arbitrator would be bent in that direction.
Regardless of whether such a system, if it is set forth in writing and agreed to, would pass muster, there is the question of whether the plaintiff in fact agreed to it. And the answer to that, of course, is no.
Right. In the Phillips case, this very procedure was followed, as I understand it.
That's correct.
And there was agreement by the plaintiffs to the defendant to pay all the costs,
well,
and then went to arbitrate.
That's what Judge Canelli ordered, and then subsequently, after reviewing the decisions along the line of Steinkamp, Judge Canelli in McDonald's case said, no, we're not going to permit such rewriting of the agreement. And I think the latter view was correct because...
And what case was that?
There's a case called Perovich versus McDonald's, I believe it's cited in our briefs, in which Judge Canelli basically changed the opinion he expressed in Phillips and decided that an offer by the defendant to pay the costs is a change in the agreement, and you can't do that. I submit that that is the correct viewpoint because the plaintiff has the right to look at whether there's a potential unfairness in having the defendant pay all the costs and intelligently say yes or no. It's not something which can be crammed down in some sort of a waiver theory, as the defendants in this case propose. It's a totally different arrangement. It is a rewriting of the arrangement, and it is one which the plaintiff must consent to. The plaintiff did not consent to it, so what we have is one agreement which the defendant backed away from enforcing, and another agreement which the plaintiff never agreed to. There is no agreement to arbitrate.
Let me ask you this, in terms of the prohibitive costs, you know, discovery, you started down the discovery road in terms of that, and then discovery was stopped. What specific evidence was in the record that the cost would be prohibitive?
What happened was that when the evidence was produced in the Phillips case, the defendant in this case said, stop, we'll make this offer, and that ends the need for discovery, it ends the need for inquiry into whether the costs are in fact prohibitive. What I've just described is the evidence that came to light in the Phillips case, in which caused the plaintiff in this case, or the defendant in this case, to not attempt to enforce the agreement as written.
Well, I understand that, and so, but then what I want to know is, what evidence did you put before the district court judge in this case that the costs were prohibitive?
We never got to that point, because before any hearing was held on that, the defendant said, let's not enforce the agreement as written, here's a substitute agreement.
But doesn't the district court have to, in making this determination, look at what the prohibitive costs would be?
No, Your Honor, not where the defendant offers to change the agreement and abandons the enforcement of the agreement as written. The arbitration agreement is not mandatory. The defendant for example, can consent to proceed in court if it wishes. In this case, it tried to substitute a new agreement. That is the problem. We didn't agree to the new agreement.
Right, but hasn't the Supreme Court said that when a party wants to invalidate an arbitration agreement on the grounds that the arbitration would be prohibitively expensive, that party has the burden of showing that? And what I'm asking you is, I understand the defendants made the offer, discovery stopped, but the court still has to look, if that's the grounds on which you want to invalidate it, the court still has to look at something to, in order to make a finding that it would be prohibitive versus just speculating.
No, Your Honor, because the defendant obviated the need for any such finding by saying, we would like to change the terms of the agreement.
What they said was, we'll obviate the need for money and we'll pay the cost.
That, I believe, is, for the reasons I explained, a change in the terms of
well,
the
agreement. Well, it also is a kick to your requirement that you have to show the excessive cost. And they say, there won't be an excessive cost, we'll pay them.
If you are not imposing a new agreement on the plaintiff.
No. If we have the burden of showing the excessive cost, and it is obviated that the defendant says we'll pay the money for the cost, that really turns the thing upside down. It's going to cost, to be too expensive, okay, we'll pay it. No, can't you change the agreement?
Well, it does.
It doesn't make any difference. It certainly eliminates the problem you might have of claiming, increases the problem you'd have of showing to the judge that you're going to get burdened with excessive costs.
Well, that's true. The problem with it is that it subjects the plaintiff to an entirely different.
Yeah, but under the agreement, it is the plaintiff's burden to show that the cost of arbitration would be excessive.
Under Greentree, if the defendant did not make the offer.
No, in this case, with the arbitration agreement, it would be your burden to avoid the arbitration agreement to show that the cost would be excessive.
Yes, you would have to show financial inability to pay such fees.
That's the only agreement that you agree is operative.
That's correct.
And you didn't show it.
Right.
Because the defendant obviated the need for doing so by its offer.
That's relatively circular, but go ahead.
The problem is this. Any arbitration agreement provides a balance between the problem of parties being able to afford it and the problem of if one party pays the entire cost of the entire
well, well, how do you get around the First and Fourth Circuit cases which have held that a defendant's offer, not an agreement, okay, but a defendant's offer to cover the cost of arbitration moves the plaintiff's concern over prohibitive arbitration costs. How do you deal with those cases?
Those cases are not consistent with this court's decisions in Steinkamp and Stone, namely that the plaintiff must agree to the terms of any arbitration agreement. The defendant in that case, but often to pay all of the costs, changes materially the agreement.
But you see, they're talking in terms of an offer. The offer. They're just saying the offer, not the agreement.
The problem is that this court in the Steinkamp and Stone decisions said that an agreement is necessary, an agreement to arbitrate on certain terms and conditions with respect to certain claims. An offer by the defendant of that nature materially changes the agreement. Instead of having to face prohibitive costs, the plaintiff now has to face the question of whether it's fair to have the defendant pay all of the salary of the decision maker. The plaintiff never agreed to an arbitration scheme in which the defendant paid all of the costs of the decision maker. That is the problem. There is no agreement, and that's why Perovich is right. Judge Flower's earlier decision in Phillips is not correct. It is not a greater includes the lesser. It is a certain balance of risks and duties, and that balance is totally changed by the defendant paying the entire salary of the decision maker and the entire costs of the arbitration proceeding. It is simply not the same thing, and the plaintiff did not agree. Turning to the issue of class certification, the defendant in this case sought to postpone class certification for the obvious reason that it did not wish to take an inconsistent position with that which it took in California.
But didn't it? They made it real clear that they were not addressing the class certification question, and the district court stayed the discovery and stayed briefing on class certification. So how can the motion to dismiss be converted into a substantive response on the class certification?
Because the defendant then, notwithstanding its attempt not to have the district court address the issue, asked the district court to strike the class allegations. The defendant did this for the reason that it didn't wish to take a position inconsistent with that in California. Under the flipping class is basically the same class in both here and California.
But there was no briefing on the class certification question.
The defendant wants the opportunity to argue that facts which are not only stipulated to but agreed to be true in California are not true. It wants the position to argue legal positions which are flatly inconsistent with those it took in California.
But it doesn't. It hasn't argued anything. I mean, the district court hasn't looked at any of the arguments. That's what I'm saying. There's like been no briefing on the class certification question. And the motion to dismiss, you'll concede, did not deal with class issues.
The defendant attempted to raise it in its reply. And the entire... Let me go back a step. Under the Supreme Court's Anakin decision, we can't really have a different standard for litigated class and a settlement class, except manageability issues. California basically follows federal...
Yeah, but see, the district court didn't even look at that question. That may well be true, what you're saying. But the district court didn't even have a chance to look at that question. You know, there was no briefing on that.
The defendant addressed some but not all of the class issues, trying to get multiple bites at the apple and trying not to commit to a position inconsistent with the position it was secretly taking in California without the knowledge of the district court. I think that this court has enough before it to apply judicial estoppel.
Well, how can we don't even have, I mean, I just feel a little uncomfortable. We don't have the facts here before us. We're supposed to deal with the class certification question on the basis of this settlement in California, which is not really clear, you know, the impact it has. Certainly there's a dispute between you and the appellants on the impact of that settlement. I mean, we're supposed to just take a look at that in the first instance here without having the benefit of the district court's review?
I think the court could do it, but it does not have to do it. But I do wish to make the point that...
So what will we do then? If we don't have to, I mean, we have to look at the class certification ruling. Oh, you're saying we could send it back on
the
same?
You could ask Judge Court to decide whether associates is judicially stopped as a result of the California proceedings. But under Anakin, they can't just say that a class is appropriate for settlement purposes. They actually have to agree to facts, for example, that there are X number of class members, that the issues common to the flipping issue are A, B, and C. And they did that. They do that in their briefs, they do that in their order, and what they want to say in this case is, that doesn't apply to the Illinois flipping class, which is a subset of that certified in California. I don't think this court has to permit them to do that. I don't think it should permit them to do that, but it certainly could ask the court to decide whether they're permitted to do that. Unless your honors have some other questions, but thank you very much.
Sam?
Why don't you start on the last point? You know, that is that, you know, that you, I guess, raised certain issues in your response. Well, I guess in your reply to the motion to dismiss.
Okay. I think the record will show, Your Honor, that the issues raised were the issues related to the arbitration issue and the existence of the arbitration agreement, and that was the nature of it. With respect to that issue more broadly, of course, Mr. Edelman made all these arguments to the California judge, which rejected them in terms of finding that this was an arm's length negotiations, rejected the conspiracy theory. But it sounds to me from what I just heard from opposing counsel, there really is no disagreement among the parties on what the court should do if it gets to the class certification issue, which is to send it back to Judge Kaur to fully consider the Rule 23 issues and resolve that. By going through the normal process of briefing, argument, discovery on Rule 23, I thought I just heard opposing counsel concede that that would be the appropriate way to address the issue.
No, but they could.
Yeah.
Okay. They could if they wanted to.
Right.
We know all along. We didn't ask.
Okay. Right. That's right. And then he was only talking about judicial estoppel, as I understand it, just the specific issues that were resolved there and the impact that they would have here. I don't know that he was saying open up the whole. I mean, I thought he was arguing that he didn't want the whole can of worms open on class certification. I could be, I mean, I don't.
Well, then I misunderstood him.
I
certainly would not suggest that this court cannot do what it determines to be the appropriate course of conduct here.
That's a good thing to do.
Ms. Chan has counseled me wisely on how to appear before this court. But I do want to spend just a minute, if I may, on what I think is, because I think I fully made my arguments in the class certification issue, the due process, the need for us to go back on Rule 23, unless there are further questions. And I'd like
to... Edelman made a distinction between an offer and an agreement with regard to other circuits and our circuit. Do you agree with that?
Well, in fact, I do not agree, and I think the very case he cited, the Popovich versus McDonald decision by Judge Canale, specifically addressed the issue and, in fact, distinguished from the situation there where the arbitration agreement did not provide for the defendant to in any way share those costs. Judge Canale specifically distinguished that from his earlier decision in the Phillips case with respect to the arbitration agreement here.
So he didn't change his mind. He just said it's a different case with different facts.
Yes, and he specifically did that in his analysis in the decision. And
there's no indication in the second case that he said I was wrong in the first case and I'm not changing my mind.
That is correct, and he provided the reasons for the difference. And his reasons for the difference in his views as between the two cases was that in the Phillips case, which is the same arbitration agreement as here in the Livingston case, the agreement specifically provided for the defendant to pick up the costs in the circumstances where the American Arbitration Association did not decide to reduce it, and also specifically addressed the American Arbitration Association rules, which further allow for the parties to recalculate the cost as between themselves in the event that the costs are prohibitive as to one party.
Now, do you know whether the arbitrator knows what the specifics are in terms of who's paying? You know, Judge Bauer raised some questions concerning that. I would think that the arbitrator wouldn't know that that would be something that the court would not. The court would sort of make that determination. Do you know, under the rules,
Your Honor,
the arbitrator know that the defendant is the one picking up the tab instead of everybody splitting it?
I do not know the answer to that question, Your Honor, but that was one that we could certainly provide. But what I do know is that the American Arbitration Association has a very careful set of rules, and I apologize for not being able to cite them chapter and verse to you on this issue, which are specifically designed to deal with ethical issues and other issues to make sure the arbitrator acts.
Well, not professionally in those rules against one party agreeing to pay all the costs.
No, there is not, Your Honor. That's specifically permitted. And in addition, the judicial review process, of course, of an arbitration award provides the safeguard. The one other point I guess I would like to make, because I see that my time is out, is with respect to the Stone case cited by Mr. Edelman. In fact, the court's decision there was that the arbitration agreement did not apply to the dispute at issue in that case. That was a brokerage context, so I don't think that could fairly be used as precedent in this situation because of that distinction. He cites here Steinkamp, which was not briefed or provided to the court previously, and I don't think it's appropriately used for that purpose. With that...
Well, no, but on this, American Arbitration Association counsel is going to provide us with any cases he might be able to find to show that it's not a proper procedure that the defendant pays. I mean, it might be helpful if you would submit if there's anything from the American Arbitration Association that, because I believe, as you do, that there's nothing improper about it, but that would be good for us to have, I think.
We would welcome the opportunity to provide the court with that additional authority, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to mine.
If you could submit, submit that within 10 days, please. Thank you very much to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement. We move to the third case.